What is that delightful song?
That delightful song is one that you might be more familiar with than I am. It's a common redpoll, migratory winter bird that often comes to northern Minnesota. Doesn't normally make it as far south as where I am in Stillwater, Minnesota, but I just love that kind of questioning
Yeah.
sound it makes. Just sounds very inquisitive.
So red poles, we'll talk about those a little bit because I don't know. We're seeing all the things changing as always. This is Season Watch from KEXC, and I'm Heidi Holton with Charlie Mitchell. But also, this is the migratory time of the year. If a name is something like red pole, does it mean there's some red involved?
There is some red involved.
Okay.
They have a little red forehead patch, the males do. I wonder whether red pole, does pole have, it's P-O-L-L, not P-O-L-E. Janelle, I'm wondering about the etymology of common red pole, and that is what my friend Google is for.
We also, I want to pose to you, Charlie, as you work with your friend Google there, that as we get closer to the holidays, what I'm really hoping for is kind of some ideas from you on curious nature folks and basically what would you want in your stocking, kind of a thing.
Gotcha.
Books or things. So keep that in the back of your head, and we'll be providing that during this podcast.
Absolutely. I have ideas.
Okay, good.
I have ideas. So pole does come from, etymology is English. It means head. So
oh, okay.
Basically redhead.
Okay.
Yeah, that makes sense.
There we go.
But yeah, they move in flocks. They can be super abundant at feeders, especially if you're feeding black oil sunflower seeds. They love those ones. Keep an eye out.
One question some people I know, this is also getting towards the gifts, and you don't have to answer it now. We'll put this out there. But if anyone listening, or you, Charlie, has any ideas or background with those bird feeders that have cameras.
Ooh.
I was
obsessed
thinking
with them.
About them, of getting one for Tom, maybe for, but I don't quite know if it's something I should get or if they're worth it or any of that kind of stuff. Do you want to tease us
I
with
found
an idea?
One on sale.
Okay.
That's sitting downstairs that I just haven't put out yet. So this is motivation for me to get it out there.
Okay.
And what I'm really hoping that eventually an owl will nest in it. I got one that should be about the right size. But in the winter, I'm really hoping that some flying squirrels hang out in it, because then, you know, they'll be in the nest box all day while I'm awake, and then out scurrying around all night when I'm asleep. And I would just be so happy to see a bunch of southern flying squirrels just snuggled up together.
Charlie's got the Home Alone look right now. If you were sitting with us on this Zoom conversation, hands on her cheeks, so excited. You know, most people don't care for the flying squirrels, right?
So I would argue that most people in northern Minnesota do not care for the flying squirrels.
Okay.
Most people in southern Minnesota have no idea that we have flying squirrels. Because they're mostly nocturnal. In the big woods area, they have plenty of places to nest that aren't people's attics. And they're so nocturnal, you don't see them unless you're hearing them running around your attic. Gosh, they're adorable.
Yeah,
They're so cute.
This is just, my brother, I think it took about 4 or 5 years to get the flying squirrels out of the walls of his house. And so it was rough for him.
I know intellectually that would be a large problem and would probably keep you up all the time and you would never get any sleep, but they're animated fuzzy little blankets. I love them. Can you imagine like a human-sized one and getting a hug from one? It'd be so cozy.
Oh, you've crossed into dangerous territory. That's given me the chills here.
Heidi just full body shuddered.
I'm not there yet. I'm learning so much being on Season Watch Pod with you, but I'm just going to say I'm not quite there yet, but I understand. I hear you.
I'm also a weirdo and nobody has to be there. I understand.
Weirdos are included. This is for nature nerds like us. I'm slowly becoming a nature nerd myself. Each week we are bringing you conversations and questions. I feel like we end up leaving each episode with more questions than answers
Yes.
sometimes, you know, which is great. That's what this is about.
That's the point. And honestly, that is a whole experience of being engaged in nature, is there's far more questions than answers, but all of them are interesting. And what I love is hearing, you know, the kids get curious and get interested. And we're gonna listen to one a report here in a second from Little Falls students. So these students know more at, I think they're in 6th and 7th grade, than I did at age 29, 30. And I'm still learning from them. You know, it's amazing the knowledge that they're starting out with and how much they're going to be able to discover going on. It makes me just so excited and so hopeful. And I can't wait to find out everything they learn. But yeah, this is from our Little Falls students, Chad Kaddick's science class.
This is Emily
and Megan reporting from Little Falls Middle School. This is our phrenology report for the week of November 16th.
There were several sightings of barred owls this week, including a great video of one catching a small rodent.
This week, we saw and heard both tundra and trumpeter swans.
One thing we learned this week was that northern shrikes produce a pellet similar to owls to expel bones and hair.
We are still seeing some sandhill cranes around Little Falls, so they have not all left on their migration yet.
We have noticed several different bracket fungi, including turkey tails, artist fungi, and birch polypore. We had our first snow on November 9th.
Most of us were able to get out and see the Northern Lights as it put on quite a show this week. It was a unique week as more people were sharing their pics of Northern Lights than pics of their deer.
On the forest floor, we have noticed smaller organisms that stand out, including haircap moss and British soldier lichen.
Although they are not a common sight around here, this past week we heard the unmistakable call of a raven.
A classmate found an owl pellet and picked it apart to find it was filled with chipmunk bones.
We are seeing large flocks of wild turkeys in the fields and moving through the woods.
A fellow student found a huge bald-faced hornet hive that was built on a chair in his deer stand. It was several feet tall.
This is our report for this week. Until next week,
keep exploring, keep discovering, and keep connecting with the great outdoors.
Amazing.
Okay.
The things that class sees.
Yeah. All right, we've got a lot to get to here.
Yeah.
When
to begin with, on their Instagram page, which you can find at little_falls_phenology, they have the videos of this barred owl. They have photos of the Northern Lights. They have this huge flock of turkeys. Yeah, if you haven't seen their Instagram, please check it out. But this is all like crowdsourced from the class and from other people in their school. They send their photos to the teacher, Chad Kaddick, and he uploads them all, and it's just this fascinating document of everything going on in the Little Falls area. I absolutely love it. And then they're finding these owl pellets, northern shrike pellet.
Okay,
amazing.
let's talk about pellets here, because when I first heard this on Tuesday, I assumed this was like finding little rabbit pellets, right? Like scat in the woods.
Yeah, or deer pellets, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which is a completely logical conclusion to jump to. In birds, a pellet is a little bit different. When we're thinking about, ooh, I don't know how into the weeds here I can get, but in mammals, the way that mammals excrete is different from how birds excrete. So mammals can both pee and poop. Birds only have one hole called a cloaca where they pee, poop, and do any reproductive things. And so the way that a bird, especially like a predatory bird that's eating a lot of stuff that's indigestible, bones, fur, that kind of stuff, instead of it passing through their entire reproductive system, it comes out as a pellet from the top end. So much like a cat horking up a hairball, this is owls and northern shrikes, other predatory birds, or things that are eating a lot of stuff that just can't be digested, will get rid of that out the top end.
The delight in your voice makes me think that you've been long examining pellets.
This may be true. This is absolutely true. Because again, the closer you look at things, the more wonderful things you discover. And, you know, I think a lot of us were lucky enough in our science classes, at least lucky enough if you're me, horrified enough if you're some of the people in my class, to, you know, do the dissection of owl pellets. And you find all these tiny little bones. You know, the little falls students were talking about looking through the pellet and finding out there were the bones of a chipmunk. I know from my end, you know, you can go through and you can find bones, but identifying them is a whole different ball game. There's some very useful dichotomous keys you can use, but I won't get into that. But yeah, you do find all sorts of fascinating things just hidden in that stuff. And the good thing about owl pellets is that they're very dry. They don't have much of a smell, or it's just the fur and bones with almost no like digestive waste attached. Whereas things that come out the other end tend to be a little bit more wet and smelly, and you know,
They've
you might
gone
not
through,
want to.
it's like they've gone through some process where
They have,
this is
yeah. They've
close
gone
to.
through the entire digestive tract and come out smelling like it. The pellets, less so. But John Latimer was also surprised to hear about this northern trike pellet. And so while talking with Clinton Dexter Ninehouse from the Saxon Bog, they discussed that a little bit. So I wanted to highlight that this week.
I had a report this morning from one of our student groups, and a pretty well informed. And they reported that the shrike actually regurgitates a pellet, much like the owls. And I was unaware of that. So tell me more.
Well, if you ever want to see one, John, I've got one in my freezer right now. So
You're
if you
talking
ever
about the
want to see it,
pellet,
I've
not
got
the
one.
shrike.
Yeah, so
What did
it's
I
a
do?
cool thing. Like birds that eat things with bones and they can't process them, like fish or mice and voles, or even hard-shelled things like beetles. Kestrels and merlins cough up pellets. Grebes will cough up pellets. Owls and almost all of our raptors will cough up pellets. But yeah, shrikes are fun. That was a bird that that pellet. The story I have with that is I was guiding a couple of folks. God, this would have been like 2017 or earlier. And we saw this shrike and it didn't fly away right away. And usually when you see a shrike, they just sort of disappear. Like you get a good look at one and then they're gone. But this bird was sitting and I said, well, let's just watch this bird. This is kind of interesting that it's not going anywhere. It's either hunting or it's doing something else. And we watched it do that sort of like hunched back thing. I was like, oh, I know what's going to happen here, you guys. Watch this. And it popped up the pellet, flew away, and I got out of the car and I ran into the ditch and I dug through the snow. And I found that pellet, and I have that shrike pellet in my freezer now. I've been trying to figure out what to do with it because that's not a thing you find a lot of.
No.
And so I you know, want to put it in resin, or I want to put it in something just to have it for education. But there's a skull in it, so you can see like the top of the skull of whatever it had eaten in the pellet. So I don't really want to take it apart to see what it was, but like I don't know, it's kind of a neat thing you see when you're out and about in the world.
Now, Charlie's
I
just
am
been.
really enjoying Heidi's response to all of this.
Charlie's smiling the whole time. We don't have time for it, but I would like to go one by one at some point to see what's in each of your freezers, because I suspect all three of you have some things in there we maybe want to know about, but maybe not. But
For
anyway.
sure.
The for
I love that
sure.
you had the exact same set of reactions this time around
Yeah,
you
I'm
did
still.
last time.
I keep talking about I keep learning. I'm still not quite there on and now that I think about it, John definitely said regurgitation there. So I should have known better, but you know, I'm still thinking about the pellet, not the, you know,
I
basically.
think that's a very reasonable assumption to have made, especially because we do talk about deer pellets and rabbit pellets all the time. That I think that's part of the reason why scientists come up with such ridiculous words is that there are these very fine nuances that, like, you do need technical terms to work with, but then you get to the difference between predation and depredation, and I start rolling my eyes a little bit.
I love that Clinton there is like he's a detective, right? He's seeing this
Oh,
shrike
yeah.
making this movement where he knows he might have access to a pellet. And then
Right?
he's gonna stop the car and dive into the ditch of snow to find it. Oh my gosh.
Right? The levels, the number of like naturist levels you have to have leveled up to reach that. Because, first of all, the shrike is a very nondescript bird, it's gray and white and a little black.
About how big
I think.
of a bird is a shrike?
Okay, someone who's listening is going to come fight me on this.
No, no, it's okay.
But I would go with like robin size.
Okay. Okay.
I would say about robin size. It could be mistaken for a gray jay, but I think a little bit smaller than that, but just in terms of the coloration. And so the vast majority of us would be driving by this bird, not even thinking about it, probably not even seeing it. Not Clinton. Clinton stops, sees it doing the like cat about to puke up a hairball thing, and is like, buckle in, guys. We're in it. And just, and then herring off to go dig it out. These are the people that I need in my life. And like, this is also the kind of behavior that has gotten me a lot of weird looks in my lifetime. And so it's very validating to hear from other people who do these things.
Yeah. And I'm going to hold the three of you to the freezer check at some point. I think that would be fun.
I probably have more things to admit to than listeners would approve of. But I mean, talk about delight. You have to be a good naturalist to see that opportunity at all. But then you also have to have this childlike joy. Like, you can hear in Clinton's voice how excited he is to see some bird hawk up a disgusting pellet. And that's, just fills my little heart with joy.
If this is automatically bringing up stories for you, or you want to ask us a question here, don't forget you can interact with us. The Season Watch Pod, we do that through SpeakPipe. It is speakpipe.com/season_watch_pod, but you can find a link to that on our webpage or your podcast platform. And Clinton, we should say, from the Sac Zimbog, the naturalist there.
Yes. The naturalist, only naturalist who's on staff there. There are many other people who are knowledgeable in the area, but yes, truly, truly a person who has found their calling. He knows that area very well. And
yeah, I think that is one of the, there are so many hidden gems. You know, of course, my focus is more of northern Minnesota, but I also know where you live or the state of Minnesota in general. There are places that you can go and experience wildlife. You can walk, you can, I mean, all of these sorts of things. And the Sac Zimbog, I've only kind of driven through there. It's it's a large expanse with a lot of different land types within it that bring in a lot of different creatures.
Yeah. At least in my experience, completely unique place, because the land is, I believe, majority privately held, although the Friends of the Sac Zimbog do own part of the land. But most of the birders who visit are birding by car. There are some trails and stuff that you can go on, but the vast majority of people are visiting in cars and driving around looking for these incredibly charismatic, gorgeous birds like great gray owls or snowy owls. The owls are a big deal. You also have all of the like beautiful evening grosbeaks, crossbills, all of these fascinating migratory creatures. You get my favorites, the pine martens sometimes pop out to visit some of the bird feeders. But to anyone just driving through who hasn't visited internationally to get there, these are just some country roads that like you drive along, and then all of a sudden you see like 30 people out on the side of the road with lenses the size of your entire thigh, all pointed somewhere in the forest. And what? I will say the people watching is almost as good as the bird watching.
We took a different route as we were headed to the North Shore this year, and we ended up going through Duluth. Help me remember the name of where I went, where all the Hawk Ridge. I was going to say, where all the hawks are. There we go. And for so long, we were in conversation with Laura Erickson for The Birds, a great segment you hear on Mondays. And I always imagined Hawk Ridge would be like, oh, a giant visitor center, you know, sort of like a little state park and have all this stuff. But this is what we found, a road where a bunch of cars were parked, a bunch of people with giant lenses and things hanging around their neck. And there was like almost like a food truck of items about nature that they just bring. It doesn't sit there all the time. And the wonderful staff were in there. And people were so kind. telling, you know, like we had just missed mm-hmm. some really good stuff. We were there in a good weekend. They just invited us in, man, and were showing us everything. And it was, mm-hmm. It was not what I thought it would be. And it was kind of a lot better. I do want to say a couple things about Sac Zim. So when I was getting ready for our conversation with Clinton, I was looking into the land there and the habitat. And mm-hmm. okay, so it's a black spruce and tamarack bog. It's an upland aspen maple forest, floodplain forest, sandy upland pine stands, rivers, lakes, farms, meadows, and towns in there. So there is so mm-hmm. much. It's a beautiful place. But I also want to put this alert out there because every year our good friends and the estimable hosts of Green Cheese Trivia, the Crab Sisters yes. of Julie and Betsy, live in Meadowlands. And they are so angry every year that people do not realize people live there. People will just stop yes. in the middle of the road and not mm-hmm. realize like there is a life here. Some people are headed to work, you know, picking up their kids, doing the normal life stuff that, you know, it is a place where people live as well.
Yeah. Yep. And, you know, people get so excited about a bird that they're like throwing their binoculars at a person's house. Maybe let's not do that. Yeah. If you are headed to the bog, Friends of Sac Zim Bog website, let me look it up here, has a great birding the bog etiquette page that I highly recommend you look through. It's saczim.org, saczim.org, and birding the bog etiquette. You'll find it. It's easy to find on their page, but yeah, there are real people who are making their lives here and like do need to go to work and have already seen that great gray owl 5 times. So just be sure you're being respectful.
But I will say all the years I've known the crabs, their enthusiasm of getting to live there and what they see has not waned.
Mm-hmm.
And if you maybe, you know, get to know them a little bit, they may tell you where to go. They know what's going on. I'm not giving out a phone number or anything. I need to follow up myself. That's going to be one of my goals, is go visit and have them drive me around.
As with anything else, building relationships, not just with the land, but with the people, it's really important. And yeah, I had the joy of seeing Julie Crabb when my wife and I visited last year, and it was delightful.
Oh, I didn't. I recommended that to you. I don't think I remember that you actually did it.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, it was great. It was just a brief hi and bye, but yeah. And, you know, I've known of Julie Crabb for forever. I've met her, I think, at Riverfest a few times, mm-hmm. but it was great to actually like get to see her in her natural habitat, so to speak, and go explore that natural habitat too. I didn't see a pine marten, but this year I will.
We would love to hear from you. Are there some special places? I mean, sometimes people want to keep them secret, but are there trails? Are there places that you go that you get more connected, feel more curious, and want to pass mm-hmm. them on to others, so we also have those feelings? Let us know through a voice message through SpeakPipe. We'd love to hear from you. In fact, we had a absolutely lovely message this week. Maybe someone you know? I'm not sure.
Maybe someone I know pretty well, yeah. My own dear mother, Barbara, sent us a voice memo, and let's listen in.
Good morning, Heidi. Good morning, Charlie. I'm recording a voice memo because my daughter said, "Record a voice message, Mom. I'm busy." So I have a comment about this week's podcast. And it has to do with night vision and the ability to see the amazing northern lights, which we were outside watching, and they were quite amazing. And as usual, my sisters and Haley, my lovely daughter-in-law, caught beautiful pictures of the northern lights on their cameras, as you mentioned in the podcast, much better than what I could see with my eyes. And I just want to mention one additional detail that you probably know all about, but you didn't mention, and that is our amazing retinas. And they have rods and cones in your retina. Your cones are responsible for color vision. They're right in the back, in the center of your eye, in an area called the macula. And there are 3 kinds of cones. They're responsible for color. And rods, which are throughout the back of the retina, can detect black and white. They're really sensitive to pick up light. That helps you see in the dark, but they're not good at seeing color.
Charlie.
Thank you, Mom.
A whole family full of dorks. Your words, not mine.
But yes, that is what I just sent you over chat. Yeah, we do have a whole family full of dorks. Now, I would like to set the record straight here.
Okay.
That I did not say, I'm too busy, Mom, send a voice memo. What happened from my perspective is we move the curtain a bit. We record this on Wednesday and goes out Thursday. By Friday, it's already in my rearview mirror, and I'm working on the newsletter. So I unsuspectingly finished up the newsletter on Friday. My cousin had a wedding that evening, so I'm one of those millennials who's lucky enough to live right next door to their parents. Our shower is broken, so I went next door to use theirs. Trundle on up the stairs, and I hear my mom say, I'm listening to your podcast. It's great. And I say, thank you. And, like, get three steps closer to the bathroom when I hear Mom's chair, like, drag back from the sewing machine, and then her little feet come over, and she rounds the corner, like, finger already wagging in my direction, going, it's rods and cones, honey, it's rods and cones. I have no context for what she's talking about. I'm thinking shampoo and conditioner. And I go, what? She's like, you're talking about light sensitivity and you're talking about, you know, like the shutter length of cameras, but you're not talking about rods and cones. Okay, now I understand what we're talking about. But lest she think that I'm spreading misinformation on the internet, she does have a point. When I'm talking about light sensitivity, I'm talking about the sensitivity of our rods and cones. And so, for instance, I was talking last week about how I could see the reds really well in the sky, but the greens appeared more white. And Dr. Barbara has a point. That is because of the sensitivity of our rods and cones. The red light was putting out enough light energy, enough photons, for my rods to be able to pick it up. The green was light enough for my cones, the black and white ones, to pick it up, but not for my rods to pick it up. So yes, Mother, rods and cones are very important. Let's set the record straight.
I don't even want to say the word eyes anymore. I just want to say rods and cones. Like, how's my
rods and cones? How are my rods? Rods and cones.
Yeah. How are my rods and cones looking today, Charlie? I love it. You never know.
Yep.
Where conversations are going to lead people and what learning, even from your mother, we are going to get. You know.
Yep.
So Barbara,
I also think you can hear in that voice message the clear I must have been a very obnoxious teenager, because you can hear her say, I know you probably already know this,
yeah,
but I just wanted to point out, I'm sorry, Mom, for whatever I put you through.
And Barbara, you're invited anytime to contribute to the podcast, because it was wonderful to hear from you. So, and thank you for listening. I'm assuming Dr. Barbara is also telling other people about it, which is what we hope. We hope more and more people listen. Mm-hmm. We hope more and more people use their rods and cones and just go to the website and click on that start recording button and send us a message, right?
Yep. You know, use those rods and cones to go investigate an owl pellet.
What is wrong with me, Charlie? That's your band name this week, Rods and Cones.
Oh, Rods and Cones?
Of course, yeah, it is.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my gosh. Well, thank you for listening to another edition of Season Watch. We have had a delightful time, and we're glad that you are with us. It is a production of KAXE, the first rural public radio station in the nation.
Yes. Our classroom this week was from Little Falls, Chad Kaditz's classrooms. And thanks to good old community science, we have these wonderful recordings of the bird calls. We had the common redpoll, and then the common raven is going to send us out. And those are courtesy of Paul Marvin through Zeno Canto.
And thanks again to the Minnesota Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. Again, what are we hearing now?
This is the common raven, also known as my dad's ringtone.
Little extra tidbit for you podcast listeners. This is John Latimer. I'm Heidi Holton talking on the air this week about some of the plants that we're seeing, and not just the invasive buckthorn, but plants that are still holding their leaves and might still be green. Here's our trusty staff phenologist.
Other plants like the leather leaf and the Labrador tea, which are populating the swamps, these are ericaceous shrubs, and they also hold their leaves, primarily chemistry and nutrients. They just don't have them. Bogs where these plants grow, bogs and swamps where the leather leaf and the Labrador tea grow, just don't have a lot of nutrients, period. They just don't. And so these plants are much like the pines in that they hold their 1, 2, and 3-year-old leaves, and then once the leaves become 3, they drop. And so the plant is always going to have leaves on it. Now, if you're driving along this morning and you're looking at some of these bogs or swamps and you see this undergrowth of sort of a rich reddish brown, it is probably Labrador tea or leather leaf. And both of those grow together. But interestingly, if you got up close and looked at them, the Labrador tea leaves lay down the stem, so they are like the branches on a balsam. They kind of go down the stem. And in the summer, they'll gain some turgor and they'll become more erect and turn green again. But this time of year, they're sort of this reddish brown, and they're going to be laying down along the stem. And the leather leaf, also reddish brown, those leaves are going to be laying up against the stem. So the leaves, if you look at them closely, there's no comparison. The Labrador tea has a fairly long, narrow leaf that is rolled at the edges and very hairy underneath, very fuzzy underneath, designed to not lose moisture. And you might ask yourself, why would a plant growing in a swamp not want to lose moisture? Well, the truth is, none of those plants like having their roots in water. So they are all growing sort of above the water table. And the water table fluctuates. And if it drops, they might be denied water for a while. And so they are prepared for that by having this leaf that is basically the kind of leaf that you would find on a desert plant. It is designed to not lose moisture. Those leaves are going to be on the Labrador tea, down the stem, on the leather leaf, up the stem. The leather leaf is half the size of the Labrador tea leaf, doesn't have that rolled edge, and simply is a fairly heavy leaf, as you might expect for a plant that wants to grow a leaf that will hold up for 2 or 3 years and also not be subject to herbivory, which is insects coming along and chewing on them. So they're quite well designed. So in the swamps, the red leaves, lab tea, and leather leaf. In the uplands, gold thread, hepatica, all of the lycopodiums, the princess pine, the northern ground cedar, the club mosses, all of those are going to remain green right through the winter, and that's their adaptation.